Welcome to the latest episode of Global Class, a podcast where we explore the international expansion stories of the world's fastest growing companies and the career journeys of their globally minded leaders. My name is Klaus Wiehe, and I'm here with my co-host, Aaron McDaniel.
Welcome to another episode of Global Class, the podcast that explores the stories of top global growth executives, which we call entrepreneurs, and the global growth journeys they had led for the world's fastest growing companies. Today, we have a very special episode for you, our 30th episode, in fact, and we're excited about our special guest, a longtime friend of ours. Klaus and I wanted to set aside a special episode to talk with this guest because of the hand he has had in leading global growth for top companies like Evernote, Weebly, and now his own venture, Relevant, a company that helps global seed Series A stage tech founders unlock an unfair competitive advantage in new markets through a unique marketing system that he, his co-founder, and the rest of the team have been building. We, of course, are talking about our good friend, Troy Malone. Besides being fluent in Korean from his time living there, he is a true entrepreneur by every definition, and someone whose creative and sometimes counterintuitive ideas have fueled the growth of companies who have been lucky enough to have him as part of their teams. He is a Global Class founding advisor and one of the first people we knew we had to speak with when we started researching our book. Beyond all his great experience, Troy is an awesome storyteller, and we hope you enjoy the stories that he shares in this episode.
All right, Troy, welcome to the podcast. We're excited to have you on today. As you know, we've known you for many, many years, and I'm really excited to today's conversation. I've actually known you for about now 7 or 8 years, I think, since your Weebly days. And so we're excited to dig a little bit into your story, your experience over the past many years. We know that you've been in international business for about 20 years, I believe, right?
So about I think 15. Don't give me 15? Too much. About 15. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Not that old. Actually, we have to correct our homepage, Aaron, because you say 20 years. So we're making Troy a little bit older.
20 years sounds really good, but I had some experience before that. I have 20 years experience, but 15 in international.
We got to say 15 plus then. So I guess to kick today's podcast off, Troy, why don't you share a little bit more about your entrepreneurial experience? What sort of shaped this mindset in you? You're certainly a globally minded leader. Can you give us a little bit of background?
Yeah, so it starts rather early. I went on a mission for my church when I was 19 years old to Seoul, Korea. At the time, I had no idea where Seoul was on a map. I knew it was in Asia, but I didn't know that it was actually, where exactly it was located. I had to find it on a map. And this is back in the days before we had really computers were not ubiquitous. So I was literally going to an Encyclopedia Britannica and looking at where was South Korea. So I had no idea. But that was the start, I think, of me getting outside of the US for the first time and seeing that it's a big world out there with a lot of different cultures and recognizing that coming from the American experience, we have such a big market, we have a tendency to be like only thinking of ourselves, like that way. And it gave me the opportunity to realize that, wow, there's a lot of different cultures, a lot of different ways of doing things, a lot of different ways of living that work really well. And, that was, I think, the first awakening in me in wanting to kind of explore, understand different cultures, et cetera. And from there, I stayed rooted. After I got my MBA, I stayed rooted in the US for a number of years and then got an opportunity, because I spoke Korean, to work at Evernote when Evernote was just growing like gangbusters. And it was a tremendous opportunity to take Evernote into Asia. And that was my first entrepreneurial experience, I'll say. And luckily, it was at a tremendous company experiencing tremendous growth, and I could do most anything I wanted to do. So I had kind of the ability to go out and experiment and really figure things out. And that, I think, set the baseline for me being able to go into new markets and figure things out quickly and see success. So that was that. And then I went to a number of other companies after that doing the same thing.
Do you think you attribute that to the culture of Evernote allowing for that, or some other factor?
I would say it was really the culture of Evernote, and specifically the CEO, Phil Libin. I ended up working with him for around 10 years at different places after between Evernote and other companies that he's founded. And I would say that he really set the culture in that regard, where he knew that we needed to go international. He had no idea how to do it. And he is very good at finding capable people and trusting them and giving them leash and letting them get out there and do it. So I would say, yes, it was definitely cultural. And I would say Evernote was probably my easiest experience as it related to working within the organization and helping people understand what we needed to do internationally.
Can you elaborate on that piece, easiest experience, and compare that to other experiences? Why are you saying easy?
Yeah, I would say because Evernote was growing so fast and we were rather early, most all of our systems, processes, et cetera, across the company were still in flux. Right. It's not like we had a system that was already in place for everything and everything was known and it was working smoothly and therefore there was no change and I'm coming in to disrupt, right? It wasn't that situation, which is a more common situation, I would say, taking companies into international markets. So there was a fair amount of comfort with change, which was good. And famously so, though, I'll say the only department that I ever really butted heads with, but in a friendly and fun way, was the legal department. So I was the guy coming in and saying, hey, we need to set up an entity, a legal entity in India or, different countries. And they would always be like, oh no, here comes Troy. Like, he's going to, tell us to do something crazy here. So the legal department was the one where I really had to spend a lot of time relationship building and making sure they were comfortable with what we were doing. But it was fun. They were a great group of people.
Yeah. So as you know, we talk about this this mindset, the global class mindset versus the legacy mindset. And you talked a little bit about it around processes were not set in the organization. And so how do you recommend companies to think about going international, right? Because we often get that question, when should we go international? And when talking to you right now, it sounds a little bit like your experience was easiest before they had super hard coded their business around their first initial market, right?
Right.
So when do you think it's going to be easier or better to consider these things before you're too biased towards what's already been built? Can you talk a little bit about that, Troy?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say with Evernote, the interesting dynamic that we had was that we were young, but we had very good product market fit. And I think whenever I get that question, I always say you shouldn't be going international until you have product market fit in your home market, right? Right. That's a common thing for younger startups to think, wow, we got to go global, we got to go international. But if you don't have product market fit yet, it's not time. Right. So we had product market fit, definitely. And we had good visibility into what countries were kind of organically growing with us. So that made it a little bit easier for sure. I think at different companies that I've worked at, like a Weebly, where we were hard coded. Right. And we had everything kind of working in a certain way, and this is the way we do it. Like a lot of that organizational inertia was there. Then I had to kind of poke around the edges and figure out, okay, like if we're going into Europe, figuring out the privacy regulations and GDPR, and this was at a time when GDPR hadn't happened yet. People weren't as familiar with the regulations over there, et cetera. So it was a lot more education around the edges. That's kind of how I worked at subsequent companies where there was kind of this hardcore coded entity that I had to morph and change on the edges to go international.
Gotcha. So this happens to be, not only is this a special episode because you're here, Troy, it's our 30th episode. We're doing this on video. We normally do just audio only. So those watching the video, you can see one of two key things about Troy. One is he has one of the most awesome backgrounds on video meetings that you've seen. So it looks pretty cool. But also one of the many things we love about you, Troy, is the awesome stories that you have. There are just so many stories that we heard, and we'd love to for you to share some of them and maybe to put them into a little bit of context as it relates to a bit of Global Class. One thing we talk about in the book is this notion of needing to have a global layer on the agile or lean methodology, and how you can't just on one end assume everything's going to work the same way from your initial market when you expand to new markets, but also on the other end of the spectrum, not assuming that you change everything, because then it becomes very hard to manage the complexity of many different models. But one of the core pieces of that process in what we label as step one of Global Agile is what we call localization discovery, where you go into the market and truly understand what that market's like by talking to key stakeholders. I think, Troy, in the past, you've referred to it as a listening tour that you do, so that it's not just researching from headquarters, but actually going into the market and having those conversations. And one of the great examples of that we remember you sharing had to do with Evernote expanding into India. And what you found as it related to credit card processing and how things seemed when you researched from afar versus in market. Would love to hear that story from you.
Yeah, that's a great story. And it really taught me the lesson that no matter how much research you do from afar and how much trust you put into the research that's out there that you can get your hands on from research firms and online sources, that you kind of have to be on the ground and really vet it out and double check it. And what happened in India is I did a lot of research online, and all the indications from the research was that India had kind of turned a corner on credit cards. So a lot of people in the demographic we were going after, the new middle class in India, all had credit cards for the most part. And that was kind of like, oh, wow, great. Well, that's going to be good from a payment processing standpoint. We don't have to worry about that as much. But then when I got on the plane, went over there and did the listening tour, as I call it, and I literally listened to everyone. I mean, you know, if I'm in a taxi, I'm talking with the taxi driver. What apps are you using on your phone? What do you do? How do you do this? How do you pay for that? Right. And I started to notice a theme as I was talking with a lot of different people in India, and they were all telling me this similar story, which was, oh yeah, we all have credit cards. And they'd pull out their wallet. Like, of course we have credit cards, but we don't use them. And I'd say, well, why? Like you all have credit cards. Why are you not using credit cards? And this theme started to emerge. Everyone has an auntie that would tell them a scary story about a cousin or someone in their family who got in credit card debt over their head, got in real big trouble, either went bankrupt or had, you know, it was just this scary, scary story about, so never use your credit card. So it was interesting that like the data supported the fact that like the capability was there. They had credit cards, but culturally they didn't use them. And then over the subsequent years, a company came into the market and really turned everything around and got people comfortable with using credit cards because they give some great incentives to get started with their mobile pay app. It was Paytm, which is everywhere now. And they turned the market to where it went from everyone has them to now everyone uses them.
Right.
So understanding those on the ground dynamics culturally, et cetera, give you a full picture of both the data and the research with the reality on the ground and why those dynamics are playing out the way they are. So that was instructive to me and helped me throughout the rest of my career, as I would never take anything for granted. And if I was learning about something, I would go and see it happening in the market, whether it's payments, how people use apps, et cetera. So that helped for sure.
That's one of our favorite stories, Troy. But then once you've done that discovery, you've understood how you need to change and adapt your business model, your technology, whatever that is, to address a local need. How do you then translate that back to the leadership team at the headquarters? Sort of that phase two that Aaron showed, where it's a little bit aligning corporate strategy with local strategy, and also maybe taking one of our other frameworks into play here. The four commitments that we developed in the book, right? You talked about autonomy and trust. We talked a little bit about clarity communication in the past, But in that resource alignment piece, that's really, really difficult because you have to take away resources from other places in the organization where things may work and things may not fully work in that local market yet. And you have to do this big change and convincing of,
we need
to do X, Y, C. And that seems to be a big mental leap for companies to take on. How do you actually go practically to do that and convince your CEO, your founder, and the leadership team to say, okay, hey, Troy, we're gonna support you with this thing that's very uncertain and ambiguous. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I'll say, you know, payments is one of those classic elements that falls into that bucket.
Right.
And typically what you're dealing with, or what I've dealt with in my career, is you have someone who is, a PM, a product manager, who's over payments for a big app like Evernote, right? That's a big job. That's a big deal. Right. And any little tweak is scary, risk, has some risk involved, et cetera. Like there's a lot at play there. There's a lot of inertia holding you back from payments or any tweak to payments. And what I would do is tie it to ROI. So payments seem like a straightforward kind of case from an ROI perspective of how much incremental business can we get by taking local currency, et cetera. But it's not a science, right? It's kind of, it's kind of Troy coming to you or whoever the executive is over international expansion, kind of saying, here's all the research. Here's what we, can expect within this band. But at the end of the day, it really is like the market's going to tell you what the market will tell you, right? So payments are definitely like that. I have another example. I was in Indonesia and I had become friends with this really great business guy in Indonesia, and he was installing kiosks in 7-Elevens. And 7-Elevens in Indonesia are really cool. They usually have two levels, a place where you can hang out up top, like a cafe type thing. And then the lower is like a 7-Eleven, right? So totally different vibe. But he was installing these kiosks so that people could pay cash for digital stuff.
Wow.
Concert tickets, this, that, right? Like even like peer-to-peer commerce, you could go there and pay for it there. So we got Evernote payments for premium on kiosks where people are paying the clerk in cash. And then, in the kiosk, getting upgrading to premium. So that's how crazy payments can get. I would say it's ROI. It's going back with kind of like, this is a kiosk in Indonesia. And people are like, what the heck is that? Right? Like, what are you doing? It's like, hear me out. Here's kind of the business case for it. So a lot of things are just business case driven. And frankly, a lot of enthusiasm and selling. I feel like you're almost raising money in a venture capital sense internally at your company.
Right.
Is how I think about it.
So in Indonesia, it's not super apps, it's super kiosks.
It's super kiosks. It's amazing. And the 7-Elevens are epic.
There you go.
Like you go there and hang out,
So let's say you're in a situation where you can't get those resources and you're not really feeling you're moving the needle yet. How do you then convince the CEO to hammer on the table and say, hey, we got to change this. We need more resources to develop X. I know you have a story there. I want to pull that out of you a little bit.
Yeah.
So can you share a little bit about that?
I have a fun story. There are times where you're trying to be persuasive. You've done all the research. You put the business case together and you're trying to get an ear and you're not getting it. And for obvious reasons, for understandable reasons. So at Evernote, we were an all Mac shop. We had a Windows app, however, and we had an Android app. But if you were to go to our offices in Silicon Valley, the only Windows machines that you would see in the whole facility were by the engineers who were kind of sequestered in a corner away working on Windows, right? And there were like 7 or 8 or 9 of them. But it was totally siloed. And I was in a world in Asia where Windows was so much more the platform of choice than Mac. And so I was coming back from these experiences, hearing about bugs, hearing about issues, hearing about, hey, why don't you add this? What's going on with this? It hasn't been updated in a while, et cetera, et cetera. Clearly more resource needed to be put at that. I wasn't getting an ear. So what I did is I went out and I bought a really kick butt machine, Windows machine, a great Android phone. And then I went to Phil's assistant, who I was really close with. And I said, look, you know all his passwords. Let's get these devices configured with all of his apps and everything running. And then I sat down with Phil and I had him commit to using those two devices, his mobile and his Windows machine, for a full week. And let me tell you, it made a difference. It was really cool because I essentially forced him into a situation where he had to look at head on and realize, okay, we need to really come up with some plans here to kind of up the ante on this side of the house. I thought it was pretty clever, fun. You know, I'm kind of a fun, you know, joke around kind of a guy, but in such a way to get an outcome, right? And it was kind of so over the top and so kind of crazy that it worked. You know, you can't do that with every CEO, but Phil is a tremendous guy, and we had a relationship that I could kind of pull that off. And I had to just be clever and think outside of the box.
So this is actually a perfect lead into a good place we can go around relationships, right? So a lot of what we've been talking about is surrounding one of the big cores to how to be successful globally, which is around localization, figuring out what needs to change, what doesn't, but also getting that internal alignment around it. The other side, what is one of the most important things, if not the most important thing, is the people side of things, right? And one of the keys that we talk about in our framework around team building, and in particular at the local level, is this overlap you need to have between local knowledge and company knowledge. And you know, if you look at the traditional way of doing things, it was the expat model. We're going to send someone from the country, you know, they're going to go figure it out, kind of ivory tower, the driver's going to drive them around, and we're going to do things the company way.
Yeah.
You're not really going to be successful that way. On the other end, if you don't have that company context and you just hire someone locally and you don't structurally set them up to get trust built and know how to get things done, you're not going to be successful. So it's that overlap, the bottom two circles in what we're showing on the screen right now. You have a great story around that, just to double click on Evernote in India with the, I don't speak the local language very well, but I think it was the Dabawalas. One of your secret weapons was having that local knowledge because of Anirban, who was a colleague of yours locally. Would love to hear a little bit about that, how that story played out specifically.
Yeah, this was really cool. I was blown away with this. And these are the kind of things that I just love discovering. So in Mumbai specifically, there are Dabawalas. and these are guys that have been around for hundreds of years that are couriers. You know, talk about Uber Eats before Uber Eats, right? Like, these guys are couriers who go around the neighborhood and collect all of the lunches that people have made for, you know, their husbands to go, you know, at work. And it's a service where they get a ton of these things, and they do these cool things. They carry them. Oh yeah, here we go. Yeah. So they carry them on their head, bikes, everywhere, you know, and they're bringing these box, they call them tiffin boxes, to the person at work to eat, right? They've been doing this for hundreds of years. It's very traditional. I mean, this is something where you wouldn't notice it as a foreigner. But anyway, we were trying to figure out some, you know, how to do some interesting marketing. And we were doing Evernote Business, trying to reach these people that were eating their lunches every day. And Anirban, my guy in India, and again, it's so key to hire local and someone who is immersed in that market, knows it well, and is very vocal on these kind of opportunities. He brought it to my attention, and I was like, you can advertise. You know, you can put a card in each lunch. Wow. Like, how cool is that, right? Like, if you think about all the traditional ways of reaching out to people, there's so much noise. For a Silicon Valley company to do something like this, that is so immersive in that culture and so local, it changed everything for us for Evernote Business. It got us so many connections and calls and sales calls for these different companies in Mumbai. And it was, compared to Google or any of the Facebook, you know, cheap as heck and highly, highly effective from an ROI perspective. So yeah, having local people and truly listening to them is absolutely paramount. You know, I have another story about that. Like Jeremy, my guy in Taiwan, told me that he wanted to put our office in a night market.
Right.
And I was like, that sounds crazy, but I kind of like crazy things. So walk me through it. He put together a beautiful proposal, walking me through all the thought process. We ended up doing it, and it made all the difference, not only in Taiwan, but Korea, Singapore, and other places. We started doing that because the press, the local press, loved the fact that we were in a more local place, not the expected Silicon Valley financial district place to be. So that also made a huge difference.
And a lot of these things happen also because you've developed a very, you know, a good trusted relationship with these people, right? Can you talk a little bit about that? Because it's not just about hiring that person and bringing him over to the headquarters and just meeting and greeting for like a week. You go a little bit beyond that as well. Can you talk a little bit about, for example, Andaraban with Utah, et cetera? Because essentially business is based on trust. And how can you create right. that foundation to then have common understanding? And then with that trust, you can then grant a lot of autonomy to that local team. Can you talk a little bit about your approach to kind of building and generating trust within a team?
Yeah, I think I've been really fortunate in my career to have hired amazing people, luckily. And number two, have developed very deep relationships with those individuals such that we are connected forever. it's a explicit understanding with most of my former employees that I'm still in touch with on a weekly basis, right? Andaraban is no different. He came out a couple years ago to Silicon Valley for a board meeting he had to do. And I said, right. Well, what are you doing? Like, get over here to, I had moved to Utah. And I said, come over to Utah. It's gorgeous. You're going to love it, you know? And so he jumped on a plane and came over to Utah for a couple of days and spent time with my family, my father as well. They went on a hike that they just absolutely loved together. But yeah, that depth of, connection is serves you extremely well, and I think the way that I get that, at least, is every person that I hire, I come up with a plan for them day one of what do they want to accomplish and look like on their exit day,
right?
And I come up with a plan. You know, I just talked with Margarita Rojas, who is over in where is she? She's heading up Europe. She's in Ireland. She's in Dublin.
Right.
So she's actually in Colombia right now, but she's in living in Dublin, running Asana's marketing for EMEA. Right. And, we came up with a plan for her at Weebly. When I hired her, she was kind of the LATAM person. Right. And I said, look, I'm hiring you in as the LATAM person, but the goal is by the end of your Weebly experience that number one, you're executive. And number two, you are global. You're much more than just LATAM. You're going to be Europe. You're going to be Asia right. as well. And we did that. And now she's in, you know, over there in Dublin doing an amazing job with EMEA marketing. So
right.
I think that's important with employees.
Yeah, I think that's also where you have your qualities, Troy, because you talked a little bit about obviously the founder, Phil, being very good at hiring people, but also you very good at hiring people, because I remember Margarita from the Weebly days, I interacted yeah. with her as well. And sort of the general feeling that I've had every time I've engaged with the team is this drive, this motivation, this passion for global, and really being a part of that in international operations team, right? And I think that's really, really important, because if you don't build that within the team early on, it's going to impact, obviously, the future growth of the company. And I think it's also owed to your ability to find the right people as well. So I just wanted to throw that in as a comment, because I vividly remember interacting with Margarita back in the Weebly days, some years back.
Thank you. Yeah, I would say the majority of my success is not because of me, it's because of the team.
Exactly.
You know, so, bottom line, if you can hire well, you can do well. Exactly. Yeah.
In our research, we were told that was the most important thing and the most difficult thing.
Yeah. It's hard. It really is hard, especially when you're going into new markets.
Right.
You're navigating different cultures, different nuances that way. So how do you interview, et cetera? It's tough.
Maybe do you have a couple of secret tricks to that? Just a couple of recommendations there.
I would say I've done a lot in the B2C world. And B2C, it's a little easier because what I do is I skew toward people that truly know the product already.
Right.
Or at least are intensely interested in the niche in which you play. So right. Productivity, for instance, or Weebly, like entrepreneurship, right? Like finding people in that sector that are genuinely passionate about the deliverable, the ROI that we're producing for people, right? That I think is one thing that has really helped me. And then another thing has been thinking outside of the box. I did this in Korea. I did another crazy thing in Korea. I had a country manager that didn't work out. He was the expected person that you would hire in Korea. Didn't work out. And I ended up, as a replacement to that individual, hiring a young female who I actually convinced to leave her second master's program. I said, why do you need two, right? Like, let's get on with it. Absolutely amazing individual. And all I had to do with her, she was like a ball of fire, right? All I had to do with her was direct it and get her to think like an executive and act like an executive and be an executive. And she rose to every expectation that I had for her and knocked it out of the park for us in Korea. And she was absolutely, if you were to ask anyone about the profile of person that you would hire in Korea, you would not hire a young female, right?
Right.
But it made all the difference. And I think willing to take that leap a little bit and be a little bit different to cut through the noise can be helpful.
So along the lines of doing crazy things, and maybe to tie back into something you talked about when we were talking about team and people around depth of connection, that depth of connection isn't just with your team, but it also can happen with customers as well. And if you look at companies, especially if they're very tech heavy in their product or service, they tend to think more of these digital marketing, you know, non-tangible ways of doing things. You talked about, you know, a physical flyer with the dabavalas, yeah, and the lunchboxes. A couple other great examples of that had to do with, again, counterintuitive, but physical pins for premium users for Evernote, as well as having physical conferences in person, yeah, in different markets in Asia. How did those play out when you took these different, you know, marketing tactics, doing these crazy things to create those that depth of connection with customers?
Yeah, that was very interesting, and I kind of blew some minds. I remember Phil came over to one of our conferences in Korea. I think it was, we had 3,000 attendees, which was three times the number of attendees that we were getting at our big global conference in San Francisco that we, by the way, we were paying a ton for.
Right.
And my budget for 3,000 attendee conference was $5,000, which is, wow, just stupid, which is just crazy. Like,
you
how?
You couldn't even get a venue in the Bay, yeah, Area.
Exactly. But we had so much goodwill and our team was so amazing that they were able to get the venue for free. They were able to get sponsors for the conference, you know, all this stuff. But it didn't start there, right? Like that's kind of like where it ended up. And it was like, wow. And it changed our whole conference strategy for the company. But where it started was with a meetup and like these small iterations of like testing stuff out. So I started with a meetup. We got 40 people there. And I was like, okay, that's kind of cool. Let's do another meetup. Got about 100 people there. And there was a guy in Korea, one of our users, who was an author, and he was writing books about technologies, et cetera. And Evernote was one. And I went out to lunch with him after the second meetup. And he said, hey, Troy, I said, hey, Mr. Hong, let's do another meetup when I come back. And he goes, no. I said, what do you mean? And he goes, and he was like, really, he's an intense guy. So he's just looking at me and he's like, let's do a conference. And I'm like, what, talk to me. What do you mean? Like it hadn't even dawned on me that we could do a conference. Right. Anyway, listening to a user, he helped coordinate everything, et cetera. Our first conference was like 800 people.
Wow.
And it was a smashing success. And then that opened up the whole possibility to now do conferences in Taiwan, Singapore, Indonesia, other places. And it kind of became a thing. I did the same thing with hackathons. Our CTO didn't believe that we could do a hackathon. He's like, why would anyone do anything on Evernote? We're so young. You know, we had just released our API. I said, let me try. We did it. It was actually a big success. Did it at Yonsei University in Korea. I had to cold call a number of professors in the CS departments to try to convince them to do something right with us. Anyway, did it. And then Evernote became well known all over the world for doing hackathons everywhere.
Wow.
Once we kind of like broke the mind, kind of limitations on our own mind, you know, can we do it or not? So yeah, those are the kind of things, like the crazy things, the big crazy things never started, you know, the pin in India. Over time, I noticed that as I talked with users in India, they would always pull out their phone. And in Evernote, you could say, it would say, you've been premium for this long, 2 years or, you know, this many months. And they would always, as a badge of honor, say, show me this. And I said, okay, this is kind of like in India, if you are premium and paying for Evernote, that's a status symbol. That's like driving a Tesla, or that's a flex, right? So I said, okay, if this is a flex in this market, particularly when someone signs up to premium, we made a really cool, nice pin that you could put on your bag and it would self-identify you as like, I'm an Evernote baller, right? Like I'm flexing, I'm premium, right? It would say premium on there. So those kind of nuances came through just recognizing things and then experimenting with them, seeing what the results were, and if they were good, leaning in hardcore. There were a lot of things that didn't work, obviously, that I'm not talking about. But the things that did work, we were able to lean into, invest heavily in, and it really made a big difference.
One of your comments a little bit earlier about the CTO doing the hackathons and at the conference with the CEO and coming over to Korea, one of the things that we, you know, also discovered a little bit in our research, at least one of the big comments that we got from Masami Takahashi-san that led Expandable Uber and WeWork, was one of the most important things that you need to do as a local market leader is to make the leadership team fall in love with the country. And I think that's what you're really, really good at. So just wanted to throw that comment in. Another thing that I want to maybe bring to the forefront in the conversation is a little bit your ability to localize the stories around the brand, right, of Evernote. I vividly remember that you tied in that elephant logo into different sort of cultural context. So can you talk a little bit about how you approached that, how you thought about that, and how do you come up with that idea? Because that actually helped you be very effective in getting PR in those countries as well.
Yeah, that's another localization thing, right? Like when your logo is an elephant, number one, everyone loves elephants.
Exactly.
There's not a country in the world that thinks an elephant's a bad symbol. So we had that going for us. But there's a lot of countries that have actually very deep ties to elephants and meaning and symbolism behind them. It first started in Japan. We had some people at a university in Japan actually write a paper analyzing our logo and trying to determine if it was a female African elephant or, was it an Asiatic elephant? You know, they were like doing this whole thing, and we said, okay, there's something there. So I started, as I went into India, learning about Hinduism and Ganesh and like all the symbolism behind that, et cetera. You know, if I was in India, I had a certain way of talking about the logo. And, if I was in Korea, they have certain other meanings with the logo, et cetera. So, the purpose of the logo in the local market, meaning the US, was elephants never forget. We were all about remember everything. So it made sense in English, like elephants never forget, but we had to kind of tweak that in certain other markets to educate them on that connotation, but then also give a shout out to their culture as to the meaning behind the elephant in their culture. And that made a big difference. Like you said, with press, et cetera, press in some countries is very easy. If you really show a knowledge of the local market, because that is a great way to connect with not just the press, but the people in general.
Awesome. So we've been doing a lot of Evernote thinking, but there's yeah. obviously a lot more we could talk about with your career as it has gone and more currently. But you know, one thing to this, just to highlight this learner's mentality you have, there have been a few different moments that we had as we've been developing Global Class. And you know, one of them was getting some validation from Steve Blank on the agile side, from, you know, sort of the father of modern entrepreneurship. But another was when you had been starting your position at Drata, and you would come back to us and said, hey, I just got this new position. And by the way, guys, I used a few of your frameworks in working with the CEO and the C-suite to make sure they understood things. That was just huge validation for us that yes, this is something valuable for someone who's never done expansion before, but even someone like Troy, who's been doing this for years, the fact that you told us that there wasn't a lot out there that you had that you could make someone else understand, because it's not just about right. the head of international understanding, it's about the whole organization understanding. But to the point of that learning mentality, I also recall when you were going through that transition with Drata, you were talking about expanding in Korea, and you said, I got to go do some localization discovery. Yes, I've done Korea before. I lived there before, but you know, the last time I did this was 5 years ago, and a lot has changed in those 5 years. And so, you know, just to highlight that importance of not making assumptions, even when you are experienced. Could you share with us a little more about that mentality and how it's helped you in multiple places over time?
Yeah, I would say that's a key thing, a key point of learning that I've had to learn is that if you're out of a market for 6 months, you don't know that market anymore. Like that's how I had to retrain my brain, because you think you do. Us as humans, we're all pattern recognition, right? I figured out the patterns in India. I figured out the patterns in in Great Britain. We think we have, but the market, especially nowadays, and I think the acceleration only continues as far as the speed with which markets are changing, the infrastructure, the apps, the ecosystems are changing so quickly now that you almost have to retrain yourself to really own the fact that if you've been out of a market for 6 months, you don't know that market anymore. And I actually illustrated this. I was speaking at an event when I was with Weebly. It was called Koreans in Silicon Valley. And I was the only like honorary Korean, I'll say. Everyone else was truly Korean. I was the only non-Korean that spoke at the conference. But one thing I did, so I had an audience of about 200 to 300 Koreans in Silicon Valley. They've been out of Korea for some for a few months, some for many years. I learned a word, a cool hipster word from my intern in Korea called haekjem, which means nuclear fun. It's a mashup of words. One is nuclear, one is fun. So it's just like amazingly fun, right? And it's a really cool hip word. When you say it, people are like, oh, they love it, right? Like it's right. one of those things, but it's totally was happening right then. So I actually educated the audience. I said, okay, I'm going to teach you guys a Korean word, talking to all these fluent Koreans, right? And I'm like, who has heard of the, I said, now you got to be honest, like who has heard of the word haekjem? So I said, haekjem, and everyone laughs like that's the coolest word ever. But only like four or five hands went up and actually had heard it before and knew about it. So here's all these Koreans who have been outside of Korea for a period of time. Even they didn't know right. that aspect of the market, right? Right? So it's important that we keep that frame that you don't know if you haven't been there last week. You know, it's kind of the way I think about it because things move so quickly.
It's really, really cool.
I want to, we have a couple of more questions there, Troy, before we obviously end the call. But there's one question that that I've been wanting to ask you. And to be honest to the audience, I'm not sure how to frame this because it's something that came to my mind during the conversation. But you, as someone that obviously has this, I guess I would label it as cultural agility a little bit. You can go into a market, be able to adapt sort of your behavior, the way you go about things when you talk to people at in local markets. When you do that while also facing the pressure from the headquarters, let's say that command and control, let's say you're in that early discovery phase, but then they're saying, hey, we need to generate revenue, profitability, etc.
Yeah.
What does that do to someone's cultural agility on the ground? My theory is a little bit, then you go back to sort of your normal behavior, sort of that command, sort of company way of doing things when you're being pushed towards something instead of being granted autonomy and trust. I don't know if I framed this correctly, but from your experience, having faced that a little bit with previous companies, I'm sure you have, what has that done to you and your ability to actually do that discovery, gaining that understanding to then understand how to adapt and localize the business model to successfully expand? I don't know if it makes sense, but I just wanted to ask you that question at the very least.
No, that's a good question, actually. I haven't thought of that in that context before, but you're right. Like that is, I would say, a constant tension,
right?
Because it's a cultural difference. Right. And commonly, international takes time.
Exactly.
You know, international is not a snap the fingers, check a few boxes, and you got it.
Right.
It's a learning curve. There's a lot that needs to be done, and you need kind of that leash, if you will, that allowance to be able to get there. But you also need a plan, right? Like you also need a plan that you communicate and that you set expectations for.
Right.
And, you know, I've been both successful and not successful in setting the right expectations, right? Like when you get it wrong, it's painful, you know, and that's something that you have to kind of like work through. But I think the cultural agility is I don't know. I really like that aspect of the job is being able to truly understand a culture to the point that people will really connect with you. So that you can actually do good business in their country. It's vitally important, but I think if I were to kind of like think about it, when you're dealing with people outside your organization, like partners, customers, et cetera, you have to maintain cultural agility with them. Like there's no wiggle room.
Right.
With your team, however, there is a little bit of wiggle room where you can kind of like, let them know what's up and say like, here's the deal. I know that this might not, you know, feel comfortable, but this is the way we need to do it right now.
Right.
You know, and so you have a little bit of wiggle room, much more wiggle room with the team because you have that trust, right? Where you can say, hey, this might not be the way it's done here, but we're going to do it this way right now. And we're going to figure this out and we're going to figure out how we get it to a point that everyone's comfortable.
Right.
So you do have a little bit of agility there with the team, but outside you can't change the culture en masse, right? You have to operate within that with your customers, with your partners, et cetera.
Exactly. But then sometimes that leadership team doesn't understand that and they're putting that pressure on you and you sort of lose a little bit that agility because it pacifies you a little bit and you're pushing for that revenue, those metrics. And so you're forcing things faster than what you actually should because you haven't found product market fit. So all of a sudden, you know, these things happen and also your behavior and not being effective in doing your job, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah. And you can get like a false negative very easily doing that.
Exactly.
Is the problem. So you kind of try to force the issue because corporate is kind of pushing it that way. And so you get a failure that really shouldn't be a failure, but it was a forced failure, you know? So yeah. And being able to communicate that is really, really important. And like I said, I've been successful many times at doing that and other times not, you know? Right. So that is, I think, in this line of business of VP of international or international expansion, it is a key skill set and something I'm still figuring out, but it's an important skill set to have is how to manage those two tensions against each other.
Right.
So maybe let's take some of these things and time a bit together. Maybe this is repeating something you've already said, maybe it's something new, but what are some of the tough decisions that you had to make in your career leading international at these different companies? And how did you go about making them? Were they mistakes? Did they work out the right way?
I would say the hardest ones are when you make a mistake in hiring, remedying that mistake quickly is it's easy to that's the canned answer. That's the right answer. Everyone knows that, but it's hard. It's hard. So I think like when it comes to like staffing, hiring, and like knowing when to part ways with someone, that, you know, that's extremely difficult decision to make. But it's imperative that you make it and you make it quickly. So I would say those are kind of the hardest decisions. Actually, I would say hiring and firing are probably both the hardest decisions to make, because you want to make sure that you are hiring the right people. So you scrutinize on the front end and make that the hardest decision you ever make, so that you don't have to make the harder decision of letting someone go. So I would say that's where the hardest decisions are made. Other hard decisions, though, are bets, what bets to place, because you typically will have the opportunity to place multiple bets. Some bets preclude other bets from happening. So you're kind of narrowing down and focusing and choosing, which is strategy. You know, strategy is all about choosing what not to do. Those are hard decisions as well, I would say.
So before Klaus gets into the three pieces of advice that we always do, why don't you just talk about what you're doing right now and sort of the future of Troy, right, with Relevant and otherwise. Talk a little bit about how all of this experience you've been translates to today and to the future for what you're working on.
Yeah, so didn't really anticipate doing this, but I'm absolutely intensely happy that I've made the decision to kind of step away from my corporate life, right? Like I've been at it for a number of years. Unfortunately, I'm very experienced. I've been at it for a number of years, but I'm at a point in my career now where, you know, all along my career, I've mentored startups. Heck, at All Turtles, you know, that we mentored a ton of startups, it was a product studio, but I've done that over the years. And one of the themes that I noticed over my career is that Silicon Valley is great at a lot of things. One thing that I think Silicon Valley suffers from is having too much resource, and where that becomes a problem is in marketing and in new market entry. So they have so much resource that they can essentially put it all toward marketing with like ROI negative marketing, right? But we have so much, we're just figuring it out. Well, frankly, very rare that they actually do figure it out in my experience. A lot of the boardroom conversations are like, how can we make marketing more efficient? We can't keep doing this. Like, you know, we're dumping millions of dollars. And as I went into new markets, I always had a constrained marketing budget. So I had to figure out how to actually do it like a real startup and do it profitably. And so I kind of realized over the past few years that like I've actually developed some templates and processes that kind of like, you don't have to do the Silicon Valley marketing burn barrel approach of just kind of burning your cash to produce a little bit of output, but that you can actually do it profitably. So I've taken all those, my kind of templates and playbooks, and working with some amazing startups around the globe to help them with new market entry, because most startups around the globe need to be global. They need to be in multiple markets because a lot of them are starting from smaller markets. So that's what I'm doing at Relevant. I'll say I'm having a ball. Like, I am loving it. I have a partner out of New York, and he's amazing. And we just got back from a trip to Korea and Japan, meeting with a number of our customers and just speaking at a few events. So that's what I'm doing. And I'm absolutely loving it. So that's my and that's what I foresee going forward. Like, it's a fun thing.
And that's the beauty of it. Our work aligns perfectly, right? So we're excited to work with you in the future as well, Troy, on all these initiatives. And so we're moving into the last phase of the conversation. I know we spend about 50 minutes on the topic of international, and really appreciate your time today and sharing all the stories and all the insights and all the learnings over the past 15 years, not 20 years.
Yes.
So we're moving Thank you. Into... We don't want to make you older than you are.
Exactly.
So we're moving into the three pieces of advice. So imagine you are in an elevator and you have to answer these three questions very quickly. Not a Korean elevator in a big tall building in Korea, but maybe more in San Francisco or buildings
okay. smaller. Okay, 5 floors, yeah.
Yeah, 5 floors and so forth, right? So what one piece of advice would you give to someone interested in building a career around international?
It's right here. Do things. Take the opportunities that you see to expand any direction that you want to go. Right. Opportunities abound. Open your eyes and be willing to kind of like put in extra work to do something. And then that is how you kind of stair step your way into a career doing exactly what you love.
Right. The better answer, actually, Troy, I'm unbiased, is like do things, then go read the book. You could have done the other thing.
Do things and then read this book right here.
There you go.
Exactly. Looks like I always have a hard time. It's like mirrored, you know?
Yeah. All right. What one piece of advice would you have for a business leader expanding a business to new markets?
Biggest piece of advice would be to get in there and truly understand the market. Do your research, but do your listening tour. Get on a plane. Be there. Beautiful. To truly understand it.
And again, the last one is the hardest for most people. What one piece of advice would you have for your younger self?
Well, that is hard. I would say, like, looking back, I didn't realize that the opportunity of international was even there. I kind of happened upon it, but knowing what I know now, my advice would be to actively look for it, do things that take you there and get involved. I would have gotten involved, 5-6 years earlier than right. I did otherwise.
Right.
Well, Troy, thank you so much. You've taught us a lot of things. So having the right culture, having the right resources, tying it to ROI, finding the right people, doing the listening tour, localization, discovery to truly understand a market, creating that depth of connection, not just with the team, but also with customers. Not just doing things, but doing crazy things. You had some great stories around how those translated in success. And then having that agile mindset, not just cultural agility, but also this beginner's mindset as you're going into new markets and expanding businesses. So thank you for your ongoing support and all you've done to pay it forward to teach the next generation of entrepreneur. We really appreciate your partnership, Troy, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, guys, and thanks for the book. It's awesome.
Thank you, sir.